too bad, because we have a murder afoot. There is murder afoot. Hello, David. So today we'll...
seems to be the news all the time.
A very modern chapter. Now, I'm going to just do a quick review and then present the questions that we have to ask ourselves, or that we should ask ourselves, I think, in this chapter, which is chapter 21 of Malachim Aleph. We're almost finished with Malachim Aleph, isn't it? That's kind of impressive, right? So, I don't think I've ever finished a whole Sefer before here. I've always stopped somewhere in the middle. Just to sum up, king wants land. Landowner doesn't want to sell. Queen that creates plot accuses landowner of cursing king. Landowner killed. King takes property. Prophet gets angry. Promises king death. That's a summary. We could actually, I don't know, maybe we could go now because that will take care of everybody can get home warm. But the question that the few questions that one has to ask after getting a basic picture of what's going on is, did Achav know of the plot? That is, Yizebel essentially says, we can see Yizebel says, you stay here and I'll give you some property. So the question is, was Achav aware of the plot? If he was aware of the plot,
he was involved.
Yeah, then why not say it, I guess, more explicitly? Yeah. If he wasn't involved in the plot, and she takes his ring and signs his name, the assumption, the implication of the psukim is that he does not know. She takes his signet ring and signs his name. She. Good evening. Good evening. How are you? She. It's a brutal day. I said for troopers to come. And you walked here?
No.
Oh, thank goodness. Thank goodness. Yeah, I'll take that. That's Arnie's. I'll fight that. So, why
did... I didn't run out of gas on the way.
So, if he didn't know of the plot, then why does he get smeared by Eliyahu at the end, which he will? I'm sorry, I don't usually sum up the whole thing. I usually just read and take it in. But here, there are, I think, more meta questions that need to be asked. If he wasn't guilty, then why condemn Achav?
At least partially guilty. He was certainly guilty of incredible naivete.
That's okay, but the punishment he gets is death. It's like instant death. He actually does tshuva at the end, we're going to see. Mm-hmm. But it's like instant death. That is why this is maybe the harshest punishment he gets throughout. Do we have, I think we have a few extra, there's a few extra there. Sarah, here, you said I'll get it.
Okay. We can share.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there's a few extras, just in case anybody comes.
I thought that you gave
her... That's okay, just in case somebody comes.
Yes,
we'll have.
I'll leave it here.
Thank
21.
You.
21.
We're up to Navota Karmeli. I'm sorry, I did not record last week. I recorded the week beforehand. You're right. He's not completely innocent, but if he avoided the basic always saying that a king who abdicates his power and has other people do the killing for them, that he's not like a capo who says, like a mafia don who says, I'd like some people taken care of for me, but never says what he wants. So is he implicit or he's not implicit? But here, Achav didn't even suggest the plan. Achav is lying down, he's upset, he wants to die, and and it seems to be Yizebel's instigation. So if he's really not involved, then why is he being punished so harshly? On the other hand, what's wrong with him? That is, why is this issue of the land such a big deal? That is, the last time we used to have the same word, v'hu yashav lebeito sar v'zaf. The last time we saw this was last week when when the Navi came and told him that he did the wrong thing, and by letting the king of Aram go, he's going to get punished. There I can understand being pretty stressed out. But here he doesn't get a piece of property. And I understand property is nice, but, ad kadei kach, that he should go home and he stops eating bread and he lies with his face against the wall. What is it that's going on here? And he's not a simple man, Achav. He's a powerful king that rules for 22 years. So my sense is that there's a subtext here, and I think I'll be able to show you a subtext, and things are more complicated than they seem. The third thing is Navot. They have Navot killed. They make this big kangaroo court. It's Yizebel, for God's sake. She can do whatever she wants. She's the queen. Why not just take him out? Eh? Why not just, you want a guy killed, have him killed. Why do I have to go through the process of making it look like it was the king, and then we get this kangaroo court together where all the leaders of the people are in on it. The letter goes out to them and says, this is what we want you to do. The plot is not public, but it's certainly public in the eyes of the leaders of the people. If she has all the leaders of the people on her side to the point that she can have them put together a kangaroo court, then why not just have them killed? What's the problem? And the final question that I'd like to ask, I know this is very Abravanel, if you know the Abravanel, so it's very Abravanel, so where he asks all the questions at the beginning, and then he goes into these long expositions, and the only problem with it is, by the time he's on his like middle of the exposition, I can't remember what the questions were, because they're like 10 pages later. So it's a problem with the Abravanel. You have to, in order to read him, you have to have really an excellent memory. The final question, and I'll repeat my questions over and over, so I'll be nicer than the Abravanel is. The last question is, why didn't the king just take the land? I thought kings were allowed to take property. Remember, Shmuel Anavi comes and says, everybody says, I want a king. And God says, if they want a king, you read them the law of the king. And the law of the king is, he'll take your sons for battle, and he'll take your property, and he has the right to take land. The king could do whatever he wants. The king could take property. The king has that right. So with that in mind, with all these questions in mind, I'd like to take a look at the psukim, and I think in the psukim we'll immediately start to see that there's something more complex going on in the psukim. So verse 1 of chapter 21, Vayhi achar advarim eilu. It was after these events. Now, whenever you see those words Vayhi achar advarim eilu, either it happens immediately after the previous events. I think that's probably the best way to describe it now, that it's after his victory with Aram. Now, his victory with Aram was very nice, because if you remember, up to that point, we got surprised by something. This was last week, that it turns out that Aram was pretty much ruling over northern Israel. While Ahab was a good king, he was still a vassal to the king of Damascus, and it wasn't until he beat Ben-Hadad good that he starts to be able to have control over his country. And I'll explain why that's important in a second. But here, Akar Dvim Elu, Kerem Ayal Navota Yisraeli, Asher B'Yisrael. There was a guy by the name of Navota Yisraeli who lived in Yisrael. Now, right there, I start to get suspicious. That's right away where I think the Navi is trying to tell me something. Because isn't it obvious that a guy who lives in Yisrael is called Navota Yisraeli? Or if I'm going to call him Navota Yisraeli, where do I think he lives? Texas? I mean, it's a repetitive.
A lot of people are called the Israeli if they originally came from
Israel. Yeah.
And they're not currently living in Israel.
Yeah,
yes, that is significant, and I think that's important. The pasuk here is emphasizing that not only was he's born and bred and living in Israeli. Why that's going to be important soon, we'll see. And then it says, Eitzel, so he had a piece of property, Eitzel Hechal Achav, next to the palace of Achav, Melech Shomron. Now this is very interesting, because it's not saying Melech Yisrael, it says Melech Shomron. Now that's okay. We have like Melech B'Yushalayim, we don't have Melech B'Yushalayim, we have Melech B'Yushalayim. Why is it called Melech Shomron when he was Melech of all of Israel? And not only that, the camera now is going to be in Israel. That's where this is taking place, because it says, Eitel Eichal Achav Melech Shomron. That is, one might think, in fact, that the camera is in, it's a little confusing. Are we in Israel? Are we in Shomron? So we know we're in Israel because Navot has a piece of land which is in Israel, and he's Navot the Israeli. And yet the king is being called the king of Shomron. Now, if it was just by itself, that pasuk, then I wouldn't be so suspicious. Or I wouldn't read into something. But I'd like to jump ahead a little bit to after Achav or Izebel has Navot killed for the property. And God sends none other than, guess who makes a reappearance? Eliyahu HaNavi. Eliyahu HaNavi comes back. The question was, why wasn't Eliyahu involved in the previous chapter? But Eliyahu comes back in verse 17. So I'd like to read verse 17. Vayihi dvar Hashem el Eliyahu atishvi. This is chapter 21, verse 17. Vayihi dvar Hashem el Eliyahu atishvi leimor. Kum reid likrat achav melech Yisrael asher bishomron. Hine Bekerem Navot Asher Yarad Sham Lurishto. So here we say, he says, I want you to speak to the Melech Yisrael Asher B'Shomron. Hine Bekerem Navot Asher Yarad Sham Lurishto. Now. Hold on a second. We know we're in Yisrael. How do we know we're in Yisrael? Because the first pasuk says so. Looking back, the first pasuk says, "Vayihi achar advarim eilu kerem ayal l'navot ha'yisraeli asher b'Yisrael." The kerem is in Yisrael, and yet the king is being called the king of Sharon. And not only that, when God speaks to Eliyahu HaTishbi, he says, "Kum rei b'krat achav melech Yisrael asher b'Shomron, Hine bekerem navot asher yarad sham l'vishto. So how could it say asher b'shomron if he's in Yisrael? In that case, the asher b'shomron can't be referring to the kerem, because he's actually in Yisrael. It must be referring to where the king normally rules. That is, the king who is, that who is in Shomron, not the kerem, but the kingship, so to speak, yeah. Not the king. So here again, we have some confusion about where we are. It's not really clear. The kerem's in Yisrael, but we keep on calling him Melech Shomron, and not only that, we go out of his way to make a point that he's Melech Shomron. So here's what I'd like to say. There's something political going on here. This is not just a question of property. This is a question of politics, and Navot is playing the political game as well. That is, up to this point, Melech Shomron was limited to Shomron to a certain extent. Not only that, there may have even been battles in the Israel territory. Now, just to give you a geographic setting, Shomron today is around 10 kilometers north of Shechem. So you're talking, you're in the mountains of Samaria. Yisrael is to the north of that. That is, in between, after you pass through north of the mountains of Samaria, below the Galil HaTachton, before it starts getting mountainous, you have this vast plain lands. And if you look at it today, as you're coming out, if you're driving out of the Shomron, or driving from the Galilee, it's this really vast plains where they have all kinds of farming goes on to this day. It runs all the way through Beit Shan, Afula, all the way to the Jordan River on one side, and it runs all the way to the coast on the other side. It essentially divides Israel in half. During the 1973 war, the Arabs almost made it the Syrians almost made it with their tanks to Emek Yisrael. That would have been a disaster, because once you're entrenched in the valley of Yisrael, not Shomron, Yisrael, you've got a pretty good piece of property. It's Yisrael with a Zion, Yisrael. It's a well-known and well-expensive territory. My guess is it probably was not fully in the control of the northern king as long as Ben-Hadad was running the show. What we saw last week is Ben-Hadad was essentially in control of Israel. My guess is that Yisrael was not completely in control. Yisrael was not completely in control of Israel. The reason why I'm assuming this also to be true is if you remember at the end of the floor and light show that Eliyahu put on, he puts on this big floor and light show where he brings down fire from the sky, and Hashem comes to him and says, "I want you to get on the chariot. I want you to put on your chagor matnecha, put on your war belt, so to speak, and run before Ahab's chariot to Yisrael." We never find out why he's running to Israel, or why the chariots are on the way to Israel. But one sense is there's a certain amount of not quite in the control of the Sumerian king, which is why I think also it calls him the Sumerian king rather than the king of Israel. That is, after X years of oppression and famine, there may be a sense of exactly who's running the show in all the parts. Keep in mind, it's not like the United States of America, where you run a piece of property and you own every last little bit of it, if that's true. It's more like Serbia and Montenegro type of thing, where you have little pockets of resistance, and there are hometowns of Tikrit and all kinds of things like that, and you're not quite sure who's in charge. My guess is, also it's very interesting, what does he have in Israel? He has a Heichal. A Heichal is a palace. Well, what is he doing with a palace in Israel if he lives in Shomron? Shomron is his capital city. I build a palace to mark my territory. So there's a sense of him being in Israel to extend his northern border further. First of all, Israel is much richer territory than is the Sumerian mountains, and also it's further north to Damascus. It gives you access to the Yam Kinneret. By the way, if you don't have the Israel, you don't have Yam Kinneret. It's a much more powerful piece of property. Where exactly Israel? Israel, I think, probably around the Beit Shan area today. Anyway, with that in mind, let's continue on and see if my point about there being political maneuvering going on. Pasuk Bet. Vayidaber Achav al Navot Lemor. Tna li yikar mecha vihi li legan yarek. I want it as a vegetable garden or a spice garden. Ki hu karov eitzel biti. It's close to my house. Vayetna lecha tachtav kerem tov yimeno. I'll give you a vineyard that's even better. You give me your vineyard. I like the location, but I realize it's a good location, so I'll pay you back plus. You can have a better property. Im tov beinach, if that's what you want, and if what you want is it's nelecha kesef v'chirzeh, well, I'll pay you a good price for it. Yeah, I'll give you silver. I think the word kesef here that really doesn't mean money; it means silver. I'll pay you. Vayomer Navot el Achav, chalila li me'adonai mititi nachalat avot haylach. God forbid that I should give my land to you. Now, this immediately, who's right here? The king or Navot? Who seems to be right? Who seems to be the firm one? Navot. Why? And everybody knows the famous law. Lo timacher haaretz litzmitut. It's in Sefer Vayikra. The only problem is, lo timacher haaretz litzmitut means thou shalt not sell thy land permanently. You're allowed to sell your land. What's the condition? It reverts back at Yovel. If it reverts back at Yovel. There's nothing wrong with selling a piece of property. Certainly not to a king. The problem is permanently selling a piece of property. Now, you could argue that Ahab wanted this piece of land permanently, although he never says so. He certainly never says so. But there's no specific isser. Now, the Rambam does mention, possibly based on this pasuk, that it is also usher to sell a piece of property. I have to do full disclosure. The Rambam feels that not only is it usher to sell your property of tzmitut, but perhaps based on this psukim, although I don't know for sure, he also says you're not allowed to sell your property at all unless you need the money. Why? Because another pasuk says when your brother shall become poor, ki amu hachicha vayavoa gael v'gaal et sado, I believe it says, or sadehu. When your brother becomes poor, then you have to get together, you have to pay back the money price, because obviously he sold his property in order to make some cash. Like Naomi, rent of him, Naomi and Ruth, the whole selling of the property. Selling the property certainly exists. So the question is, Navot is swearing to God that he cannot sell the property. That's a pretty strong swear for a halacha, which is at the least not so clear. So exactly what is it that he thinks that he doesn't want to do here? Why is he coming out so strong? I'll leave that on the table right now. He's really angry. He won't, that's a real strong reaction. He won't eat bread. He's in a state of mourning.
He's sulking.
Yeah, sulking to say the least. And he's the king, for God's sakes. You know, it's a strange action. How come he's so angry? You don't eat bread. He says to her, because now here adaber doesn't mean I will speak, but it means I speak to. Yeah. Why it's future tense, if I have time, I'll go back to it. It's an interesting grammatical event, but I'll stick to just the simple, it's past tense. And I said to him, Tnali Kamacha Bechetzef O. He says, I won't give it. Okay. But Tomer Elav Yizevel. So Yizevel says, Yisdo, Ata, Tasem Luchal Yisrael. Now the Radak is very good that this is a question, a sarcastic question. Ata, Tasem Luchal Yisrael. That's how you rule Israel? She is telling him that he ain't much of a ruler. You ask for a piece of property, you won't get to it, and you act like a baby? That's why you give up? That's how you be a ruler? Now, by the way, which means her motivation, her way of driving him, that is, it's not a money issue, according to her. The issue is whether he can govern. It's a governance issue. Even more than respect, I would argue that are you able to govern? It's not just are you the king of Israel, again, respect you want, but are you able to govern properly? That seems to be the question at hand, which is why, again, I got back to my foreshadowing that there's something else going on here than just a piece of land, and it has to do with governance in the land of Israel. Take a drink like Achashverosh, right? Vayitav libo with Achashverosh in the Megillah means you got drunk. I'll take care of it for you. Never says how. Like, I'll take care of your problems for you. You have a nice meal.
He ought
to ask Yeah, we'll see whether he knew what the plot was up.
He knows what she is.
Yeah.
That is correct. But are you guilty? It's a moral question. It used to be asked. Are you guilty if you never, if somebody comes, if I don't stop a crime, is that the same as committing a crime? On a moral basis. I'm just asking, like, on a moral thing. If I know somebody's going to steal and you don't call the cops to stop him, stop the person. Are you guilty of the same crime as the person who you knew about?
No, I'm saying if you know that he's going to commit a crime, you're somewhat assessing
it. I agree, you're somewhat. I'm wondering whether you...
It's the same thing like Ahasuerus could be. It wasn't the next line. It sounds almost like it was signed under his hand and given out. It sounds like the whole story there. It sounds like Purim.
Yeah, there's some. I think Esther knew Sefer Malachim pretty well.
Right.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. But the question still remains is this... there's no doubt that there's a somewhat of an accessory. But he gets accused as if he committed the murder himself, and the question is that justified if he never knew? So Barbanel makes the Barbanel makes it very easy. He knew. He knew about it. It's not, why? Because the Barbanel can't live with the idea that he doesn't know what's going on and then he gets punished with it. At least that's what I think his motivation is. What? That's true also.
But she states it. I will give thee the vineyard of Naboth.
Yeah, so maybe she's going to go and make a good deal. Maybe she'll wine and dine Naboth. Maybe she'll promise him double. Yeah. So you, I think you can definitely argue that. The only question is, why does the Pesukim make it so vague? Because it does seem to make it vague. But I'm going to continue on. Vatechtov Sfarim B'Shem Achav, Vatechtom B'Chotamo. She writes a letter, and she signs it with his seal. Vatishlach has. She sends it to the elders and to the Chorim. Here Chorim doesn't mean the Hurrians like it does back in Avram's time, although it is very interesting, by the way. The Chorim were the Hurrians, but here it doesn't mean that. Here Chorim means the free men, from the word I don't know, what does it say in the English there? How do you have it in English? What?
Nobles
is okay. Chorim could from like Bnei Chorim, from the free men, but something like that. Keep in mind that nobles were, you know, free men, the same that they, in the sense that they may not have had to go to war or pay taxes of some sort. Asher Biro Yoshima Mavot. So here's the letter. Was that, what does it say, free men?
Yeah.
I like it. Free men's a nice translation, actually. I think there's something to that. Vatichtav Basifarim, and she writes the letter like this. Kiru Tzom, Kol Tzom. Now here is a little confusing. Why a fast day? Well, let's find out what happens, what she wants to happen, and then we'll go back to this question of why is she calling a fast day, because Radak gives another explanation. So, Kiru Tzom, call together or whatever, V'hoshivu et navot b'rosh sha'am. When you're moshiv people, that means you're moshiv them for, that's when the, when you're moshiv the people, when they sit, that's like the root story. They sit at the entrance of the city judging. You're talking about the judges that sit down on these benches. We dug up Kel Dan up in the north. They found these gigantic benches outside of the walls of the city, the gates, and that's where the judges would sit. That is, convene a Congress. Because the Congress, keep in mind that the judiciary and the legislative were not separate at this time. They were essentially together. The rulers ruled and judged. That was the job. Oseh Sdaka and Mishpat L'chol Am. And who's in charge of all the shoftim in the city? Well,
no.
Here, take a look what it says. Navot, exactly right. It says, "Vatechtov svarim lemor kiru tzom voshibu et Navot berosh ha'am." You take Navot and feed him as the head of the Am. But who's in the Am? Who's in Israel right now? Who should be the chief of? If you get together a Congress of Israel, who should be at the head of Israel? Achav should be. Now you could argue that if Achav's in the Shomron, if he's not extant, so you go to the town ruler. And now one gets the sense, you know what it means? Navot HaYisraeli, Asher B'Yisrael. He was Navot HaYisraeli. If I say I'm Eric Levy, the West Oranger, you know, that usually indicates that I could be the head of my, not only possibly certainly significant, possibly even the most important person in the town. Also, he's got the property. Think about where the property is. Wherever the property is, it's location, because I'm sure the king didn't pick the worst property to build his heichal, and right next to it are these fields, which I'm sure were significant of Navot HaKarmeli. He's got the property, he's got the title, and he's sitting now at the head of the nation. Why isn't Achav there? Because Achav's playing I'm not a king. Remember, that's what Ezebel was accusing him of. He's playing, I'm going back to my palace and sit at my palace. Now he gets up. Now I assume he's going to eat and drink. But no. They pull together a thing, and who do they ask to sit at their head? Not Achav, but Navot. It's very interesting. Now, Navot is probably just a guy. He didn't say, I won't give you the property because I'm the best guy in the city. He didn't say, I want to give you the property because I'm trying to take over control of the city and you don't deserve any more territory in the city because you're a pretend king or something like that. No. He said, I don't want to give you the property because Chalila for me to give the property of my father. Whether he was misconstruing the law, maybe he did understand the law, or maybe he was just doing something. I think the Abravanel brings up something like Ephrona Achiti, because Abravanel makes a point that Navot thought this was the halacha, but it wasn't the halacha. But I think even the Abravanel, or possibly the Radak, says the following: it's not kavod to sell your father's property. A person doesn't do something like that. That is, when you're a leader of a city, you don't sell a piece of property. That is, that property is very expensive because you're the leader of the city. It's an indication. Land was an indication of your wealth and position, like a duchy. Is that right? Is that the word? Like a... When you have a duchy, you just don't sell property.
Yeah.
Somebody brings down the case of Avram and Ephraim. The reason why Avram really had to go out on a limb is because he knew that Ephraim wouldn't want to sell. Ephraim's a leader of the territory. It's not so simple that he'll sell a piece of property. One does not simply get rid of their property back then. Well, I'm not sure one does today. But certainly back then, property was a symbol of everything that you had. It was your land, your sustenance in an agrarian society. So you kept your property. And that may be what Nevot's saying. He's saying, listen, I'm an important person here. This is the land of my father. This is my hometown. You come here and visit once a year. I live here. This is my property, and I'm keeping it. Now, that's a statement against the king. It's not a statement that I want to be the king, but a statement that I'm a powerful, significant person. I'm not going to be my property the king. That's a powerful statement that he's making. Yes, you're the king, but don't forget about how important I am in this land. Now, what do? The people get him together, and they set him up as the head of the Beishtin. Do you follow? So you know what it looks like. It's kind of a setup. The question is, how did the people go along with this filthy plot? How do we know that it just wasn't two idiots? Because it's a setup. They get together a justices of the city, and they make sure to crown Nevot as the head of this fake kangaroo court that's getting together. Nevot doesn't know it's kangaroo court. They don't know that they're there to kill him. But what he also doesn't realize is that it looks very politically... When the king is going to accuse Nevot of treason in a second, it's going to look good. Do you follow? You just come out and you say you curse the king. Who cares? In fact, let's read that. Let's see exactly what they're going to accuse him of. It seems so petty, but if you realize that there's not a power struggle, but a seeming power struggle going on, then it becomes very poignant what Ezevo does. Voshibu shnayim anashim b'nei b'li'al. I want you to also make sure that they're sitting two liars. Now, I'm sure the letter didn't say two liars. I'm sure she... I don't know whether she said... I don't think she would write a letter that says, I want you to make sure you have two lousy people. B'li'al, by the way, is a funny word. B'li'al means... nobody knows exactly what it means. Worthless, Belial, without the yoke of God. In the time of the Dead Sea Scrolls, Belial is a name for the devil, actually. The Sar, the Malach Mavet, the Sar, the angel of evil. It's another name for the Satan. Whatever Belial means.
Aren't the people who have their way with the
I'd say Belial, it's possible. There were also the people Belial were, Yiftach got together people who were Belial. We have a whole bunch of Belial people. It usually means people who are deaf to be involved with. People who have no moral principle, I think, would be the best way to translate it. Anyway, B'nei Belial Negdo V'iduhu Le'mor Berachta Elohim V'melech. They cursed. Now, Berachta is a very interesting word here. Berachta usually means bless. But here it doesn't mean bless. It clearly means to curse. Well, how does your English translate Berachta? In verse 10?
Curse.
Right? Yours says curse also. Beirat Elohim v'melech, he cursed God and the king. V'hotziu v'siklu v'yamot. And then take him out and have him killed for cursing the king and cursing Hashem. V'yasu anshei iro hazkinim v'achorim asher yoshim bi'iro kasher shachai lehim Ezebel. They listened to Ezebel. Kasher katu basfarim asher shachai lehim, like it was written in the papers. Karu tzom v'oshiva navot rosham. So they called this tzom together and they... gotten a vote at the head of the nation. He said against him. So then they had him killed. It's very quick. And it looks like it's... At first glance...
They're calling together...
A meeting. So let's go back to Tzom. Right, so now I'm going to...
not even there yet.
Well, it will help if I go and explain what's going on with the tzom. It's possible that the coins get a fast. Rashi brings down because that's the time that people look at their sins. However, the Radak gives a viable explanation that it actually is shortened form of the word somet. Somet, or tzmitut, remember? Al timkeru et ha'aretz with tzmitut. Don't sell your land permanently. The word tzmitut means a convocation, a tzomet. Well, in modern Israel, a tzomet is a what?
A junction.
A junction. It's a place where people meet.
Mm-hmm.
So So he says that essentially called together a day of intersecting, which means a day when the judges of the city wouldn't meet all the time. This was like Congress in session, Congress / judicial in session, and it wouldn't happen all the time, but they would call this, we want to get all the people together and decide some laws. You can call that a tzom also, because maybe they fasted on those days, because the days that the people of the city knew that the judges were all getting together to see who's been naughty and who's been nice, lahavdil. So people maybe fasted on that day to do a little tshuva to see if they could get out of it. So maybe there's a cross on the word tzom and tzomet, but Radak, quoting his father, likes the word tzomet really more than tzom, and it certainly stands up here. So going back to your question, which was, now there is a gathering, there's a political / judicial gathering. So what's bothering you?
Well, I just didn't follow what these two guys were coming there and do. Were they accusing him
of cursing the king and God in front of everybody?
Okay, I thought...
Yeah. Now, the interesting thing is, now here, we have a question for you. What's that? Say again?
There's two men. Who are they? Why are they?
They're just, we don't know their setup. They're lying witnesses.
And
they're
don't
guys
give him a chance to rebut or...
Well, it's 2-0. It's witnesses. Don't forget Jewish law.
Jewish law is...
Jewish law is...
And that's it. True or not.
Based on.
Yeah. So now, here's the thing. The only thing that protects you is the law of Edom Zomerman. That is, an aide who testifies... If it turns out that he is a false testifier, and I want to get to what that means in a second, then you do to the witnesses what they wanted to do to the person. If they were going for the death penalty, then the Edom get the death penalty if you could prove that they were false witnesses. But here I want to point out something very interesting. Edom Zomim don't mean that you can show that their testimony is false. That's not Edom Zomim. If Edom say, we believe that he was wearing a blue shirt, and somebody says, two other Edom say he was wearing a red shirt, and you believe the second two Edom, the first two Edom are not Edom Zomim. Edom Zomimim, lying witnesses, or conspiring witnesses, only conspiring witnesses when you could prove that their testimony is impossible to give, which is, we saw Harold wear a blue shirt on Tuesday. Really? How could you do that? You were with us all Tuesday in California. When you knock down witnesses, you don't knock down the testimony. You knock down their ability to give the testimony. If you knock down the testimony, even if it proves that they were lying, even if you could prove that it can't be what they said is true, just what they said, the people do not suffer the penalty of Edom Zomim. If you can prove that they could not have given the testimony at all because they weren't in the position to give the testimony, then they're Edom Zomim. So here, I'll show you why that's important. Did these two Bnei Belial believe that they were telling the truth or not? They said that Navot HaYisraeli cursed the king and cursed God. They certainly didn't hear such a thing, and in that sense they're false witnesses. But did they believe it to be true? Why did they think? What information were they working on to believe that Navot had actually cursed God? What did they have in front of them? Which was signed by who? Not the queen, the king. They think the king wrote a letter and said, listen, I want to tell you what happened. You see how smart Ezebel is? It's unbelievable. The witnesses don't even know that they're lying, really. They know that they're lying, but they may think that's in a good cause. Do you follow? They don't know it's from Ezebel. Don't forget, the letter didn't go to these two false witnesses. It went to the leaders know it's a fake. I don't even want to say that. The leaders don't know it's a fake. They don't even know it's from Ezebel. Ezebel writes a document and signs it with the king's finger. It says, this is what I want you to do. The I doesn't say Ezebel. It's not like you can figure out it's a woman writing or something because it's more cursive. I mean, there's no way to tell. You think it's the... What's that? I'm sure they had... correct. Scribes write it. That scribes write it, which means that the Zakanim and these witnesses believe that the king... is commanded to do so. Now they have two possibilities. Either believe the king is also lying to get his property. However, it's just as likely that the king was sitting around arguing with Navot and said, hey, I want your property. And what did Navot say? Curse you? Curse God. Why? And somebody may even overheard. Look what Navot actually says. He even uses Hashem's name. Who knows? If somebody had just perhaps heard it snatching the conversation, they may have actually heard Navot say, go take a walk. Is it so impossible to believe that he's cursing?
God forbid this, or God forbid that, or he could have said that type of thing. I wouldn't, God forbid, I should give you that.
Correct.
Whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, and then you're using the name of God to curse the king, so to speak. He could say, I'll give you that property. I curse you. You don't deserve that property. Maybe I'm the boss around here. We can testify that they heard. Oh, they're lying that they that they are saying that they saw the event took place. But they saw the safer. The safer. I don't know this for sure. There's no way to know for this sure. It could be they think the whole everybody was aware that it was a big plot. However, if you're wondering how Ezebel had such an unbelievable ability to twist people into evil, how could all this kainim of Israel be so evil? Maybe they weren't so evil. The king said, "This is the king," and they seen Nabot is not giving the king a piece of property. And here's Nabot sitting. Where is he sitting? It's like Haman with wearing the big day melech. Who's sitting at the head of this big convocation?
They put him there.
What?
They put him there.
Yes.
That's true, but there's still indication that he's... I don't think they just put him there in accident. They put him there because he probably was the second most powerful person in the city if it wasn't for Achav. When Achav probably didn't show up in Israel, it probably was Nabot sitting at the head of the city. But no, here's the king of the city, and yet who is sitting here will sit... you know, what's going on here? So now the king says, listen, this guy curses me. He wants to take over. He won't give me any property. Now I'm adding him that he wants to take over thing. That's mine. All the Torah says is that he cursed me. But now, with the framework, you can start to see exactly what the people are suspecting. I think it's very possible the people believed it was true. But what? There were no witnesses. They were talking in the field. It was a little property deal. The king's very upset. He believes he has a rebellion on his hands. The Ish Yisrael, I'm just a Melech Shomron. That's what they call me, right? That's what the Pasuk called him in the beginning. Here's an Ish Yisraeli from Israel, and he won't give the king his due. I'll tell you what, he cursed me. But I can't, I have no witnesses. But he deserves to be put to death. The people, this Canaan probably say, you know what? Yeah. What we'll do now, obviously we know we're breaking Torah law. You know, here's the question of the means justify the ends. Do you find? The corruption is beautiful. To get people to go against what their morals are, that's difficult to do. But to get people to break Hashem's morals because they think that their morals are more important, that happens all the time. That happens all the time. I would say likely here that the witnesses themselves who knew they were lying about their witnessing the event, thought they were telling the truth about the event. And that the Zakenim who knew that they were lying about hiring these witnesses were doing so because they believed the event to be true. And the event was believable because Nabot is the second most powerful. They heard that Nabot refused to give any property to the king. And don't forget, the king has the right to ask for property. The king could ask for property. And Nabot doesn't want to give. And the king offers him a price. But no, Nabot won't give him a piece of property next to the Heichal. He wants to keep his property right next to the palace. And I think that's where the people are really being corrupted. Their good sense is being corrupted into doing evil. And it makes a much more complex story than just a kind of a bogus kangaroo court where they trump up some charges and have some guy killed. And by the way, the question is, how did they get away with getting him killed? Can you imagine taking him out? Where were the people in the city? The people in the city must have been behind the whole event. Why would they be behind the whole event? Because the word had probably gotten out that when it says Barech the king, it doesn't just mean I curse the king and now I'm going home to watch TV. When you curse this king who comes to your town and you're the second most important person in the thing, that means that what you're saying is, I don't accept you as king. I refuse. It's a mardut. It's a mardut. In fact, the only way... which then gets to the issue, the following issue. I'm sorry, let me stop to take questions now, because I think some people had some questions. I think you had some questions, and I want to show you the next piece, which proves that the issue here is that of rebellion, rather than just somebody making a random curse.
I'm a little confused over the validity of witnesses. The witness is supposed to be there firsthand.
And give warning, yeah.
Okay.
That's right.
And here they're taking a piece of paper, and
they're going with it, but it's a piece of paper from the king. They don't know it's from Ezebel.
But it's still third party.
You're right. They're doing a terrible, evil thing for which they could be punished by a death penalty. That's what I wanted to tell you. Edom Zomim doesn't even attack. The most immoral thing in the Torah is not witnesses who give false witnesses. Witness. It's witnesses who say something that they couldn't. Who say that they saw something that they did not. That's the biggest evil in the Torah. Edom Zomim are not punished if you could prove that what they said is wrong. Edom Zomim are only punished if you could prove that they could never have said it in the first place. It is more evil to put yourself up as a witness when you have no right to do so than to give bogus authorship. So I sort of lost your question. I apologize.
Well, if they came in, I mean, maybe we have to read into this, and they said, well, we have a letter
from the king. We believe the king was cursed, and now we're going to give false testimony.
Was there no process for the king to come in and test, or the king just don't testify?
No, the king doesn't know.
The king can't do anything because
get down to the people's level and
Yeah, but also there's another issue. You can't win
life and death in something.
Yeah, but
like
you
this.
Can't get into a court case. The problem is that the king, the king can't be a witness. It's his own court case. The king is not eligible for witnesship.
Yeah.
The king is saying, listen, this guy cursed me. This guy could wants me dead. He don't sell me. He won't sell me his property. He thinks he's the guy who runs the whole show, and he is running the whole show.
The king isn't.
But
the king can't
accuse him of anything. In a Jewish law, you need witnesses. No witnesses, no case. No witnesses, no case.
So these people are.
So he's saying, listen, I got no case here, but I'm telling you, this guy's a criminal. What I'd like you to do me is, I'd like you to do me a favor, and I'm the king. I want you to testify falsely on my behalf because we need to take care of this bum. And that's what they do. They're willing to do. So that's the problem. The king can't show up because the king, that's the whole problem. It's like a case where a man suspects a woman of,
the
whole race.
If the king shows up, he said.
Right, exactly right. So that's so nobody wins.
But then
he wins the case. Exactly right. Because it's Jewish law. Witnesses are more important than first, The plaintiff and the defendant have no issue on a matter. It's always witnesses. Always witnesses. The testimony of a plaintiff and of a defendant is simply to set the precedent of the case, to set the bounds of the case. But otherwise, the testimony has nothing to do with true or false. Nothing. Now I want to show you something interesting to emphasize the fact that it was that he was accusing him not of cursing him, but of rebellion. So let's read on. Verse 14. Vayishlechu Elizebeli Mor Sukal Navot. He was killed. He was stoned. Vayamot, and he died. Vayhi kishmo Yizebel kisukal navot. Vayamot, atom Yizebel achav kum, get up. Reish et terem navot haYisraeli, inherit the property, the vineyard of navot haYisraeli. Asher me'ein latet lecha kesef, it wouldn't give you money. Latet lecha v'chesef, ki'ein navot chai kimeit. He's not living, he's dead. That's a strange lashon at the end, but the beginning part is what interests me. The word reish means Yerusha. Why would the king? Okay, so he's dead. Why would that give him the right to have Yerusha? The Yerusha would go to Navot's children. Now we're going to find out Navot's children are also dead. They were. We're going to find that out. But it still doesn't go to the king. It's not like a free-for-all. The king gets the property. So you go to the kids. If that doesn't work, you go to the brother, the father. There are other people around. Now, there is a possibility brought down in one of the Mepharshim, I can't remember which one, that he was actually related to him and therefore got part of the property. It's possible. But the likelihood is it's a machloket actually of Tanaim, and it works like this. If you curse the king, if you do Marduk and Malchut, which means you rebel against the king, and you're put to death, the property of the person who rebelled against the king goes to the king. That's the halacha. That's the actual halacha. Although it's a machloket in the Gemara. It's a machloket Tanayim. Whether that's true, Rav Yossi versus Rav Yehuda. Rav Yossi believes that's true. Rav Yehuda doesn't believe it, and therefore he has to give, it's Rav Yehuda who believes that they were related. Which, by the way, also supports the idea that there's some intense sibling right. If he's related to Achav, he has some right to say that I might be the ruler of Israel, but that works out well. But Rav Yossi's opinion works out better. He inherits the property because he's accusing him not of just cursing him. He's accusing him of rebellion. And if people buy it, then people might be willing to, people have been fake witnesses for what they thought was the greater good, and that's an effective court case. And to set up poor Navot as the head of the court, to make him look even worse, in this situation, was just I hate to say it, but it's a real, Yizebel was something of an evil genius. You're not that successful. Yizebel will outlive Achav and be very successful after Achav's dead. You're not that successful unless you know what you're doing. And I have to tell you, Yizebel knew what she was doing. There's no doubt about it. But let's continue on with this story. By the way, the words at the end, Ke'in Navot Chai Kimeit. So, I don't know, you could play games with that, but the truth is it could be just good old-fashioned biblical poetry. He's not dead, he's not alive, but he's surely dead. That's like, poetry, Al Tiftechu Ben Divim Ben Adam Shein Lo Chuai. Well, Ben Divim is the same as Ben Adam, but it's poetic. It drives it home. Maybe there's something significant, but I don't know what it is. So then he takes all the property. There's one thing I wanted to talk about before we... one thing I want to talk about is the word Berach, meaning curse. Why not just use word Kilel, or Allah, or Kabo, or any of the other words for curse? Why use the word Berach? So the Ibn Jinnach, I believe, cites this pasuk. Ibn Jinnach was a grammarian who was one of the master grammarians in the 11th century, Rashi's century. a little older than Rashi, I believe, and he said that the Torah sometimes switches words, sometimes uses words which mean a different thing. He makes such a perish on the Torah in one place. The Ibn Ezra gets so upset that he says that one should burn the Ibn Zanach's books. Now, he knows the Ibn Zanach, and he likes and respects the Ibn Zanach, and he sometimes cites the Ibn Zanach. So the question... It still has some time on it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, no, it's still going. I think it's just getting older as we use it more and more. So, why? What bothered Ibn Ezra so much? Because it's very Christian, actually. The idea of taking words and saying that they mean something else is a very dangerous thing to do. Once I start that, I could do anything. I could say Jerusalem means Rome. I could do anything I want. So Ibn Ezra is protecting against those Christological problems and other things. And he says one should burn Ibn Zanach's books. Now, he didn't mean it really. That's the way they spoke. But there is a certain danger here. Now, here it's obvious that you could do a word switch, but this is the kind of thing that just drives drives the Ibn Ezra crazy, that somebody makes a lot of times Ibn Ezra will say, Sodhu, or Velo Uchala Hasbir, I can't explain. Because Ibn Ezra knows that sometimes you play games, but you don't publicly, not everybody should know, not everything that you should teach. So Ibn Zanach wasn't like that. Ibn Zanach put everything he knew down on paper. And Ibn Ezra thinks that what he's doing is very dangerous. So this is one of the cases that's cited as a switcheroo word. And it's a game that Ibn Zanach plays, I think, probably 40 times, a lot of times. And Ibn Ezra really, it's very funny. His book should be burned up. And he's talking about the Sefer Rikma, which we still have today. Anyway, continuing on. just want to take a look at... I just want to look in... I had some questions, but... I covered Adam Zomim. The production, by the way, and this I think the Radak points out, why such a big production? Why do they have to go through this whole show? Why not have them killed? And the answer is, I think, it should be straightforward now, which is that you need the production in order to make it look like a rebellion. If you just go and have them killed, the people won't back you up. The people won't back you up. It's not so easy to just pull people out and have killed. And even if you do, you ruin your kingship, You can't be a nasty, violent, terrible king and then still have a nice, long kingship because people start to rebel against you. If you could fool the people into thinking that it's a real show, that it's a real rebellion with the show, then that's why this whole deal, even though plus the fact that they didn't even know what they were doing, which is going to be a factor in a second. I'm sorry, what verse were we on, 16?
Yes.
So he inherits the territory.
Well, he goes to inherit.
Yeah, we're going to see. He gets stopped. And the reason why he hasn't is because what's happened is Eliyahu is about to meet him halfway. Vayhi Devar Hashem Eliyahu Tishbile Mor Kum Rei Lekrat Melech Achav Melech Yisrael Asher B'Shomron Hinei Becherem Navot Asher Yarad Sham L'Yishtel V'Dibarte Lav Lemor Ko Amar Hashem Harat Shachta Gam Yarashta. Now Harat Shachta has a Chataf Patach under the hay. That's because it's a question. Did you kill and then inherit? By the way, these words were very popular in Israel in 1995. I'm sure you can imagine why. There were a lot of bumper stickers in 1995, which was the year that Rabin got killed. And afterwards, there was the right-wing government, the Likud government, was it to come in power right afterwards? I can't remember. But in any event, there were a lot of bumper stickers. I remember a very nasty bumper sticker. It was a lot of... What? Oh, it was Paris. But I remember the bumper stickers, Harat Sachta Gam Yarashta. You killed and now you're going to try to conquer you're going to conquer. I think that's right. It was a very unpleasant time in Israel, I have to say. I was back in Israel for then. I was here in Battery Park City. I was working for the Israeli company for a year. And there was the murder. I remember seeing it at night. What a misery it was. And then I was in Israel back at that summer. I think he was murdered in May, I'm thinking, right about then. So I was back in Israel. I finished my job in June. So I was back in Israel in June, middle of June, July. I went back to my company, which always had non-religious people and religious people working together, and we ate together. And, of course, we all ordered kosher food because it was okay. And when I got back there, there were two separate pizzas. There was the non-religious people, which were half the company, they wouldn't just buy tray pizza. They bought the trafest pizza they could find. It was, covered in meat type of thing. and they would eat on their side of the table, and the other half of us, you know, ate our pizza on our own side of the table. Nobody was I mean, this is inside a company, you know, a company to live or die on this kind of thing. The mood was so bad. I remember that summer. It was a very difficult summer to be in Israel. The mood was so bad that it was hard to communicate with people. It was hard. Religious people could, you know, could barely the guilt, first of all, in the religious camp was palpable. That was when Yoel Ben Nun came out that some rabbis were actually issuing a death command against the Pulse of Denur against and then he had that bodyguard. So Yoel Ben Nun, I tried to talk to Rabbi Yoel Ben Nun recently about it. He doesn't want to talk about it. He doesn't even want to talk about it. He just can't talk about it. Too painful, because his own party essentially, you know, turned against him and wanted him. Some people wanted him dead for saying that people were calling for Rabin's death. It was a very bad time in Israel. That I remember very well. But thank God things are eventually, I guess, to a certain extent. You always remember a little bit. It's hard to not remember. In any event, let's continue on. So that was Harat Tzachlag Amirasta. Dibarti lav b'mor ko amar Hashem makom asher lakua kvavim et adam nevo lo kvavim damcha dam ata. So the dogs, you're going to die, the dogs going to eat your blood. Now what's interesting is there are two v'dibartas here. Do you see that? V'dibarta. And the first one starts a question, and the second one just says, this is your punishment. So everybody points out that this is like the question that was asked to Adam, like, where are you? And to Cain, where is your brother? Because the idea is first give him a chance to come clean. If he doesn't come clean and do tshuva, then hit him with the second one that you're going to die. So it's a nice idea. Hashem's giving a chance to tshuva. Pasuk Chav, Vayomer Achav Eliyahu, Hamatzatni av oivi? Now this is a difficult pasuk. Hamatzatni is also a heyashela. Why doesn't it have a chataf patach? Because under the mem is a shva. And when you have a shva in the second letter, the chataf patach changes into the patach. It gets a little confusing, doesn't it? But it is a hey ha-shela. How would the English refer to hamsa'atni? What does it say? It has to do with something like, did you find me? But I'm curious how it understands the next word, oivi. Eliyahu comes, and Akab sees him, he goes, hamsa'atni oivi. So how does it translate those words? Did my enemy find me? So my enemy, oivi, is referring to Eliyahu there. Yes. Did you, my enemy, find me? Is that how this does?
Okay.
So then Eliyahu is still the enemy. But there's another possibility, yes, which is... The other possibility is, have you found me to be an enemy? Hamatsatni oivi, have you found an enemy in me? Which means, I dare you to prove me guilty. See, he knows why Eliyahu has come down. He's not an idiot. It's only when there's no reason for him to accuse Eliyahu of being his enemy. It doesn't really make sense here. The last time we knew they were friends, Yisrael wanted him dead, but Achav didn't. They had made up after the Floor and Light show. So I think the way to translate it is, Hamatsa'atni oyivi, have you find an enemy in me? And now this, to my mind, may be a hint that he knows exactly what's going on. Because he may be saying to Eliyahu, sorry Eliyahu, you can't prove nothing. You can't prove nothing. I didn't know a thing. My wife signed a bunch of letters. You know, what could I do? Vayomer mtsati yan hitmarkercha lasot arabin Hashem. I found because you're cheating. How does English define the word hitmarkercha? It comes from the word makor, because you sold yourself. Which the Mepharshim understand, you say one thing and you do another, or you did one thing and you say another.
Yeah, but you've given yourself over to that which is evil in the sight of the Lord.
Yeah, that's so funny. Hitmakercha la'asot. You sold yourself out, which means Yizevel, which also is word. You know, you think that just because Yizevel pulled the trigger that you're not guilty, you sold yourself out to that. That makes... What? This is Eliyahu talking. Vayomer, and Eliyahu answers him, I'll tell you what I found. Because he says, did you find me to be guilty? And he says, I'll tell you what I found. You found selling yourself out to Yizevel. Once you sell out to that kind of evil, it's the same thing. And that's essentially what you're saying. You think that just because you didn't pull the trigger, because you said, you know, take care of the problem for me, that makes you not guilty. That makes you machur. You're just an addict. That's all. You sold yourself out to it. That makes you, when you sell yourself out to evil, that makes you any better? I'm going to wipe out everything that you have. There will be no people urinating on the wall. Atsur is hard to say exactly what that means, although it shows up in the Tokacha. It probably means nobody left to build the city and nobody left in Israel. That is, because of what you're doing, I'm wiping everybody out. Now, that's weird. It's a big punishment, but I'm going to continue on. V'natati beitcha kiveit kerem v'geit yeravim and yeravim kiveit basha v'nachia el hakasha sheyichatav tachti Yisrael. You did all these terrible things to make them sin. V'gam li'zevel diber Hashem li'mor klavim yochu v'tizel v'chel Yisrael. They're going to eat you up in the valley of Yisrael. Hameit l'achav ba'ir yochu ha'klavim. Whoever dies in achav in the city with the dogs leap, hameit p'sadeh yochu ha'shamayim, the vultures leap, rak lo hayat ke'achav. Asher yitmaker la'asot arav b'nei Hashem asher aseta et oto Yisrael ishto. Yezebel instigated you, but none of these kings that I just mentioned, Basha and Yeravam, are as bad as you. And I know I'm a little over time, but I'll explain to you what Eliyahu is saying. Why is he worse than anybody else? And this I heard from Menachem Yitzchak, so I'll just finish the chapter and then explain. You follow idols. So he hears these words, he rips his clothes. Vayasim sak al b'saro, vayatzom, and he fasts. Vayishka v'sach v'yalech l'at, and he starts walking very, very slowly, which means he feels bad about what Eliyahu told him. He does tshuva, so to speak. He's in mourning. Vayidvar Hashem Eliyahu atishvi le'mor, bad news for Eliyahu. Haraita kinichna achav l'fayv, you see achav submitted before me. Yan kinichna mipanai lo avi hara v'yama v'bei b'no avi hara, I'm not going to punish him, I'll punish his son. Oh, obviously the son did shuv also. One would assume that would be delayed also. By Yisru Shalosh Shanim Ein Lochama Ben Aram Ben Yisrael. There was no war for 3 years. So in the end, Achav does tshuva because of Eliyahu. I'm sure Eliyahu was disappointed. Eliyahu probably wanted him dead, but it's hard to say. Here's the one thing which Menachem says, and I think there's something true. In what way is he worse than the previous king? The previous king's worse than Devot Azara, and that's a bad thing. And I think Radak actually brings down what I mentioned much, much earlier, months ago, which was that at least the Egel Zahav, you're trying to worship Hashem, but the Baal, you're not trying to worship Hashem. And the Radak says that beferish. But the real problem here is that the sin has nothing to do with Avodah Zarah. There's no Avodah Zarah in this chapter whatsoever. No politics, there's no war in this chapter, there's no Avodah Zarah in this chapter. What there is, exactly right. But you know what the worst is? He's taken good people, and he made them evil. And that's something that God cannot tolerate. And by the way, when it says you're going to die in the fields and also die... Oh, I remember what it was. Efes atzur va'azuv. Chazal say atzur, you're going to be punished in this life. And azuv, you're going to be punished in the next life. And Achav is one of the people who's olam haba. Not for everything before, Achav is going to be punished. Sins, okay, fine. But here, say Chazal, on this one, he loses olam haba. Why does he lose olam haba? He worships the Baal and he does a little kangaroo case. Because here, not only is he lied, but he's causing the people, but he's causing the people in such a, to sin in such a way that they don't even know that they're sinning. And that's something that God apparently can't forgive him for. One thing, Avodah Zarah, so you'll come back. You do other terrible things, you fight a war the wrong way, you come back. But you start to play situations where nobody can tell the difference between good and evil, then there's nothing left. The society itself. And the worst thing is the people back you. They love you now. You want to reverse Avodah Zarah, people can decide they want to love you or not love you. But the people love you. What a great guy he is, and we defend our king. And now people don't know right from left. They don't know right from wrong. And that's something that God can't tolerate. And hence the punishment here is a punishment that Achav cannot slip away from, as opposed to all the other ones where he can. Or he does actually slip away. But ultimately, he'll pay the price. And this way, this punishment is far worse than all the other punishments. You could fight against God. But once you start fighting against your own people, you have no right to be the king. Okay, so...